So I'm Mazen Qumsi. I'm professor at Bethlehem University, and I'm speaking to you from Bethlehem area, one of the ghettos that is now surrounded and blockaded, separated from the other ghettos or concentration camps in the West Bank.
Can you just tell us a brief bit about the history? You're talking about a concentration camp here. How did it come to this?
Well, it's very simple. When the Zionist Project started, the idea was to transform Palestine, which was multi-ethnic, multicultural, multi-religious society, and make it a Jewish state. Since there were only 3% Jewish population here, the other 97% of the non-Jewish population had to go. So they ethnically cleansed us, make us into refugees, and then what's left of us are kept in shrinking ghettos like the one in Gaza, or the one in Bethlehem, or the one in Jericho, or the one in Hawara, Nablus area, many other small areas, sort of like what happened with the indigenous people in South Africa under apartheid. They ended up in Bantustans.
So you say you're a professor. What are you a professor of?
Genetics and biology.
We're being told that the Israeli government, and I think we need to start maybe separating the Israeli government from their people because they're increasingly protesting against them, that there is this kind of idea of a new master race that we had back in the Second World War with the Nazis. There is an attempt, it seems, to say that this particular race or religion is better than everyone else.
Well, indeed, this is based, the idea of Zionism is an idea of supremacy, like all colonial movements, that's what it's about. It's about that they are better than the native people and that they are more entitled to the land than the native people. So pushing the native people outside, by definition, requires some level of racism. And that's indeed what happened. And from its foundation, the Zionist movement has tried to be an exclusivist movement restricted to Jews, whether religious Jews or what's called cultural Jews, people who identify with this idea of Zionism. And it was racist also to Jews who opposed it and, in fact, killed some Jews who objected to Zionism historically. So it was, you know, you're either with us or you're our enemy. It's as simple as that for them and that ideology of Zionism.
You say they killed some, but actually in Nazi Germany in the 1930s, we had a Zionist agreement in 1933 with the Nazis, and those that did not go to Israel... millions of them were then executed by Hitler.
Well, this is some of the history that needs to be studied because actually when Hitler introduced the racial laws, the first letter that came from outside of his inner circle congratulating him on the racist laws came from the World Zionist Organization. They told him that what you're doing in Germany is exactly what we want to do in Palestine when we establish our own state, and we, like you, agree that Jews don't belong in Europe, they belong in Palestine. Not only that, they end up signing an agreement with him, the Havara Agreement, where they actually broke the boycott of Nazi Germany. So the collaboration between the Nazi and the Zionist movement went on for many years until actually 1941 when the U.S. entered the war because then the Zionists knew Hitler was going to lose for sure. So then they left that alliance with Hitler up until 1941. The Zionist movement flag with the two blue stripes and the Star of David in blue was flying in Berlin. So we have to realize that this is not what it seems. they claimed that Zionism was good for the Jews, but you know, Ben Gurion himself, when he was asked to, you know, put a little bit of money from the Jewish National Fund to help Jewish children from Eastern Europe go to England, he pounded on the table and he said, "Not one penny." He said, and this is his exact words, he said, "If I had the chance to save all the children, all the Jewish children, by taking them to England, and only half of them by taking them to Eretz Israel, of course Palestine at the time, then I would choose the latter, because we shouldn't put the interest of those children ahead of the interest of the Zionist project."
Netanyahu says that this is the Jewish dream in Israel right now, but there are many Jews, I think, that might disagree with him. And also, what is the difference between what Netanyahu is up to and the ordinary Jew around the world? I mean, I've got Jewish friends who aren't even religious that severely object to what's going on.
Yes, I mean, I was arrested also 12 times, detained. Half the times I was arrested with Israeli Jews who opposed to what the government is doing. So as you said in the beginning, we should distinguish between the people and the actions of the Zionist movement and its arms like the Israeli government. They do not really represent Jews. They try to claim they represent Jews by doing sexually increasing anti-Semitism in the world, and they ally with right-wing anti-Semites themselves, you know, like in Hungary or some of the Eastern European countries, or Zelensky and the neo-Nazis in Ukraine that are really not friendly to Jews, but they ally with them because they think alike. They think that extreme chauvinistic nationalism is the way for the future.
Can you tell us about some of the arrests that you've had?
Well, we've gone nonviolent demonstrations to, for example, stop bulldozers from uprooting 2,000-year-old olive trees or destroying Palestinian homes, and we stand in front of the military coming to destroy people's land. The military is doing this against international law and is a severe violation of human rights and international law. So we try to stop them. And, of course, they are overwhelming military force. So they arrest us, whether we are Jews, Christians, like my family, or Muslim. So that's what happens regularly here. And already there's 11,000, you know, Palestinians in Israeli jails. The vast majority of them have never picked up an arm or did armed resistance or anything. They speak or they protest and things like that.
What about the land? Because I don't know if you could tell us how old you are. You must have seen bit by bit over the years the Israeli government taking more and more land, which is not theirs.
Well, today there are 15 million Palestinians in the world. 8 million of us are refugees or displaced people living in refugee camps or in exile in European or Middle Eastern countries. And the rest of us here are squeezed increasingly, as I mentioned earlier, into smaller and smaller ghettos, or you can call them concentration camps or open-air prisons, like Gaza or Bethlehem. Gaza, for example, two-thirds of the population is refugees from 1948. So it's a concentration camp, but not just a concentration camp for the people of Gaza. It's for the refugees that were dumped in Gaza because they are unwanted, because Israel wants a Jewish state. So the percent of land that's left for the Palestinians before 1948, you know, of course, Palestinians owned most of the land, you know, and now Palestinians are allowed to live on less than 8% of historic land of Palestine. And that's not a contiguous 8%, as I mentioned. They are in about 15 different cantons.
Okay, so can you tell us a bit about where you live and what's been going on? You're in the West Bank, are you?
Yeah, I'm in Bethlehem, where Jesus was born. I'm on the outskirts of Bethlehem in a small town called Beit Sahur, which is the shepherd's field, basically, where the shepherds have angels sing and went up to Bethlehem, which is only 1 kilometer away from me. And Bethlehem is 85% of the land of Bethlehem was taken by settlers, stolen by settlers. And we live on about 15% of the district land of Bethlehem. And this 15% is surrounded by walls and checkpoints and blockage of roads, so that, since 7 October now, for this whole month, we were not allowed to get out of Bethlehem or to get into Bethlehem. And actually, that's why our university, for example, is doing online courses now, because our students from Jerusalem or Hebron cannot get here. Bethlehem is about 5 miles from Jerusalem, but we're not allowed to go to Jerusalem even before this latest episode in October. I used to be a high school teacher in Jerusalem, and I'm not allowed to go to Jerusalem for the past 15 years or so, because Israel wanted Jerusalem to become a Jewish city, and so they're removing the Palestinians in Jerusalem and preventing Palestinians from the West Bank, like Bethlehem, from going to Jerusalem. So as a Palestinian Christian, for example, I'm not allowed to go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. That's to exclude Palestinians from Jerusalem. I mean, as I said, Bethlehem is only 5 miles away from Jerusalem, so it's actually a suburb of Jerusalem, but it is isolated by a wall and a apartheid segregation wall. So the situation in Bethlehem is very bad. Just today, actually, a few hours ago, Israeli forces came into Bethlehem to arrest somebody, and there were some young people threw stones at them, and they basically started shooting live ammunition at them. At least 19 people are still in the hospital now, and three of them are in really bad conditions, and one is very critical and probably already died.
So what is your life like as a Christian? Do you have a local church that you can go to regularly?
Yes, my family is Greek Orthodox, and we have a Greek Orthodox church here in Beit Sahur. Christians, Muslims, and Jews, by the way, native Jews, have lived together in this country without any problem for hundreds of years, thousands of years. It's been multi-religious, multi-ethnic, multicultural. We've never had any problems between religions or anything like that. A problem came to us after the inception of the idea of transforming the country to a Jewish state and removing the native people. And that's where the problems arose.
What do you make of this as a Christian, looking at it? Because it almost seems like evil has descended. It's almost become, I mean, Gaza right now is like hell on earth.
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of friends in Gaza. Some of them have lost all their family members or a lot of their cousins and sisters and all and things like that. And children, lots of children already, an estimated 6,000 children have been killed. 2,000 of them are still under the rubble. But anyways, it's about, 6 children die every hour. Are killed by bombing, intentional bombing of residential buildings, schools, hospitals, etc. There's a genocide ongoing in Gaza. There is clear genocide as defined by the International Convention on the Crime of Genocide. When you deny food, water, electricity, medicine, to 2.5 million people with the intent of causing them to lose their lives. That's an intentional genocide, and it's certainly, all human rights organizations said this is horrible to watch it live. I mean, this is what's unique about it, by the way. We know historical Holocausts like the Armenian Holocaust, the Jewish Holocaust, Gypsies in Europe, genocide in Belgium, Congo, Congo's, a colonization by the Belgian army and the killing of so many people. The same with other countries have had genocides, but we've never had it live like this on TV, and we've never had it actually involve large-scale starving and denying water to an entire population like this.
Millions of people. I mean, you might say that, but there's now 36 journalists have been killed in Gaza, so there's not quite as much information coming out as there might be.
Yeah, this is intentional also. Israel doesn't allow international observers or journalists or anybody to go into Gaza. Gazan hospitals are being bombed, and the health ministry says, please send international observers to look at our hospitals, because Israel claims that there's Hamas fighters in the hospital or under the hospital. They said, send international observers, send anybody you want, neutral people, examine these hospitals, why they want to bomb hospitals. And they did bomb hospitals, at least 16 of them so far. So it's incredible. And the other unique thing about this genocide, besides the fact that it's televised live, sometimes, people even record themselves being bombed and killed and murdered. But the unique thing is that it's happening with the direct partnership of big powers, the United States, the UK, France, Germany, who are sending weapons, literally, for this genocide to continue. And not only sending weapons, in the case of the US, it's 10 special forces, Delta forces, who are now fighting with the Israelis in Gaza. It's very unusual in the history of genocide.
For most of us rational human beings, it's not easy to get to the bottom of the reasoning behind why the Israeli government is doing this.
Well, I mean, they have stated they wanted to do this long before what happened on 7 October, and the Israeli government is the most fascist, most right-wing government Israel had since its founding in 1948. And they have always wanted to finish off the job that they kept saying, like Netanyahu and his ministers, they kept saying that Ben-Gurion didn't finish the job. You know, Ben-Gurion was the first prime minister of Israel, who in 1948 ordered the expulsion of many Palestinians, but they said he didn't do a good enough job. So we have this burden that have these Palestinians left in this country, and they now their country, Israel. And so to get rid of these Palestinians, it's logical, actually. They don't feel safe having some Palestinians remain in their country, in our country, which they claim to be, has to be a Jewish state. So we're not Jews. We're not, we're children of a lesser God, or, they are God's chosen people, and we are dispensable. So, and if you resist, like what happened in Gaza, break out sort of like the Wado ghetto uprising, then that immediately becomes even a cause for further ethnic cleansing.
Around you, you have some fairly powerful states. You've got Syria, you've got Jordan, you've got Lebanon. All these states have got militaries, armies that could be threatening the Israelis in this sort of situation and telling them, look, unless you start to behave yourself, then we're going to start intervening.
Well, this is not quite accurate. I mean, you have, since Henry Kissinger, who was the Zionist Secretary of State in 1973, made a deal with Israel to provide Israel that the U.S. will keep Israel stronger qualitatively and quantitatively in any combination of countries around it. So Israel has more military power than Iran, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Egypt, even friendly countries like Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, United Arab Emirates, who are normalizing with Israel. All of these combined have less military power than the state of Israel. Israel also has nuclear weapons. So it is not true that Israel could feel threatened militarily by the Arab states. And in any case, most of these Arab states are actually collusionists with Israel, including Jordan, Egypt, all the Gulf states, etc., Qatar even. All of these countries are actually have good relations with Israel, have never threatened Israel, and will never threaten Israel because they are under the thumb of the U.S. Now, Iran and Hezbollah, of course, they do threaten Israel, not Syria. Syria is a tin-pot dictator who, you know, barely can keep the country together. But Iran and Hezbollah can threaten Israel in terms of resistance, sort of like Hamas, you know, Hamas small movement, you know, a few thousand people. You could see that even with 1,500 Hamas fighters managed to control 22 military bases, 10,000 Israeli soldiers ran away basically, and they captured Hamas, killed 400 Israeli soldiers and captured some 250 or 300 Israeli soldiers. So you know, these movements can cause some trouble, but not existential threat, if you want to think about it that way. Because Israel has such a massive military might that these movements are at best a nuisance to the state of Israel.
Well, what would you say to British listeners? Because Britain's played a major part here in the First World War with Allenby to move the Turks and the Ottoman Empire out of Palestine up to the north. The British then took over. Although the British were having a lot of trouble with the Jewish terrorists during World War II, afterwards as well, the British have played quite an important role here, haven't they?
I'm glad you asked this because Britain had a long involvement beginning in 1845 when they hired the service of George Gawler to look into the establishment of Jewish colonies in Palestine. This is how they dictated to him to produce this report, and then they supported and funded the first Zionist colonies in Palestine in 1878 and 1880, and that's what started the whole program. And then came the Sykes-Picot Agreement, French and British agreement to divide the Middle East after the First World War. This happened in 1916. And then we have the Balfour Declaration 1917, where Britain really, the British Empire committed seriously to support the Zionist project, and that's what they did in the 1920s. And then they created this monster, which is the underground Zionist movement, which turned against the British in the late, and after 1941-42. When they started bombing British interests in Palestine, and they were terrorist organizations, as you pointed out, like when they blew up the King David Hotel, killing some 90 British officers, etc. So this is a history of involvement of Britain, UK, in this struggle, and it's not a very shiny history. It's a shameful history, and UK should actually apologize for Sykes-Picot Agreement and for the Balfour Declaration because they ended up costing so many lives, 120,000 Palestinian lives so far, and the number increases as is happening in Gaza now.
So what about Hamas? Because some people are saying that maybe Hamas had just fallen into a trap by moving into to try and take hostages, that actually this is what Netanyahu wanted, that it wasn't really an intelligence failure. Actually, it was intentional that this attack on the 7th of October, they wanted something to give them an excuse to go into Gaza and flatten the place.
Well, I cannot judge on this. I mean, there are people who say also September 11 was an inside job in the U.S. You know, I don't have enough information on these things. But Hamas clearly is not the issue. Hamas is actually, I mean, I disagree with their ideology. It's an Islamist ideology, but they are moderate Islamists. They fought actually, you know, against the more extreme Islamists like Salafis in Gaza and certainly Islamic jihadists to the right of Hamas. So there are groups to the right of Hamas. Hamas was willing to accept a two-state solution, for example, if Israel ended its occupation and colonization in the West Bank and Gaza. But anyway, I mean, there are over a dozen Palestinian factions. In South Africa, there was also like 15 or 20 different factions fighting against apartheid. And people like me are independent, for example. I don't agree with any of them. Otherwise, I would have joined one of them. But there's a popular front for the liberation of Palestine. There's Democratic Front. There's Fatah. There's Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Salafis. You know, Hezbollah, Tahrir. There's all sorts of communist, socialist, religious factions, non-religious factions, secular factions, etc. That's understandable. There's diversity of views about how to liberate Palestine. And one can disagree with their ideologies. And I encourage your listeners not to focus too much on the ideology of one of these factions, because these factions are a symptom, of colonization and occupation. In South Africa, all of these symptoms are gone once apartheid is gone. The violence, the bigger violence, of course, comes from the colonizers, who do the ethnic cleansing, who do the genocide that's happening now in Gaza. That's a bigger problem, not Hamas, or for that matter, Fatah or any
well,
other.
Don't you ever get, and you and your family ever think, well, this is all going against us, it's time to get out?
You mean for me to leave the country? I mean, it's our country. There are many Palestinians who live outside the country because they couldn't survive here. Of course, there are people who are in refugee camps in Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. I'm not sure they're happy being outside their own country, even if the situation is slightly better in Jordan, for example, than the West Bank. And the West Bank certainly better than Gaza now. But regardless, I mean, people want to live in their own country. They love their country. And I love my country. I was born here. My father was born here. My ancestors, I could trace them 1,700 years here. So we are not interested in being relocated to somewhere else.
Well, many British people would say the same, you know, say, for example, if a country was to invade us, like the Normans did, you know, in 1066, there was a lot of resistance to that, obviously. But look, final question. Really, has got to be, where do you think this is going, realistically? Where is it heading, this business in Gaza now?
Well, I think there's two routes. There's the win-win situation, there's the lose-lose. Win-win, if Israel was forced to implement international law, human rights, equality for everybody, we could live either in two states or as one state with the right of refugees to return to all their lands, and this would be equality, justice for everybody. That's a win-win scenario. A lose-lose scenario is the West continues to arm Israel which is run by genocidal, suicidal, also maniacs like Netanyahu, are willing to bring Armageddon to the Middle East with nuclear weapons. They are even started talking about nuking Gaza, you know, dropping nuclear bomb in Gaza. And that will be a lose-lose situation for everybody. There is no win-lose here. Israel is not going to win. Zionism is not going to last. So they have to realize that they can choose one of those two roads. I am optimistic that the first solution will happen, which is equality, justice, human rights. But we have to push for it.
But there is also the possibility, as some people are saying, that the Israelis are behaving like a kind of doomsday cult. You know, they will push it as far as necessary and possibly with nuclear weapons and bring in other world powers.
Yes, indeed. They are talking genocidal terms when Netanyahu himself is invoking the Bible and the killing of the Canaanites that God told him that Canaanites, men, women, and children can be killed in the Bible. The Palestinian thing, men, women, children can be killed. And they are voting, you know, that they are facing human beings, as the Minister of Defense said, that we are human animals, and that's why it's okay to blockade water and food and everything from us. It's crazy. I mean, it's genocidal, but it's so suicide, because there's no way they can succeed in killing the Palestinians in the 21st century. And we will continue to struggle and live on our land, and they have to change their views. And unfortunately, you know, the enabling by the United States and the Zionists and the lobbies in Western capitals like London and Washington, D.C., that get rid of politicians who try to speak truth. These lobbies have to be faced and have to be challenged. Otherwise, we're all in trouble. I'm not just talking about Palestinians, also Israelis.
Well, I mean, I would argue that the whole world could be dragged into this conflict. Anyway, look, I know you do a regular newsletter you send out by email. If our listeners are interested in getting that, what should they do?
They can email me at info@palestinenature.org. That's our Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability. And I can add them to our email, which talks also about positive things, like how we can protect the environment and how we can teach our children to be empowered and have self-esteem and have fun also. So info@palestinenature.org.
So info@palestinenature.org.
Yes.
Okay, Mazim, thanks very much.
Yes.
Thank you very much
you.
For joining us.
Thank you. Take care.